This is going to be in two parts. So today's part one. Part two is going to be online. And so we decided, I decided to break it up into two pieces. The online portion, when we've done these in the past, I've had you write down questions, and then this one part of it's been just going through and addressing those questions from my perspective. I'm not an expert. My resume is I've been a parent for 33 years, and I've worked with parents for 33 years through sorrows and up times. And so if you'll have questions that come up during the course of this afternoon, or you already had, you can write them down. And then if I answer them, you can scratch it off. If I don't answer it, at the end, I'm going to take those questions, and I'm going to put those together into a video that kind of responses to them. And if you can also put your, we already probably have your email, but put your name and put your email on there so we can make sure, if you have a question, make sure that when it goes up, you'll get it. Now, some of you, like you guys from Orchard, glad you're here. You're not on our distro list, so you may not know. But we'll send it out to everybody who's on our regular email list and say, hey, the second part's up, and you can go listen to it. So that way you can get this part today, and the second part, you can do it whenever you want, when you're traveling or driving or whatever. And in my experience as a pastor and a parent, nothing brings more joy and hope, and nothing brings more misery and hopelessness than parenting to people. That's been my experience. I've seen kids from broken homes thrive. I've seen kids from loving homes fail. We have a guy in our church I've known since he was 18. Now he's much older. I've known him for over 30 years. And he should not be doing well. He should be a miserable wreck, but he's not. So is it a coin toss? Is parenting a coin toss? And if it's a coin toss, then why are we wasting our time here? Sorry again. Can you close that one now? I got a glare. Sorry, Sarah. I can open this one, though, because this one doesn't. We're trying to get a common ground for me and Sarah that we can both live with. I think this will work. Oh, that one's dark. I can live with that one. So it's not a coin toss, because if it really is, like you say, well, parent, there's kids from great homes who didn't do well and kids from terrible homes that did, it looks like a coin toss, but it's not. There's a lot more factors involved, but there is a tension, and the tension is your child is going to choose for himself or herself as they grow up. You can't force long-term compliance through your own good choices. You can't guarantee good outcomes by your good choices. However, you can, through your own good choices, you can empower and encourage, you can clear the path to make it much easier and more likely for your kid to make good choices. So let me tell you a story. You may have heard this in church a few years ago, but it's a frightening and encouraging story that kind of illustrates this point. I have a good friend, a chaplain out in West Virginia, Dave Reynolds, and his son, Jeremiah, 22 years ago, 16 years old, was going through a little rebellious stage, was a good kid, but had this bad spot. And one night, Dave, who was a pastor too, said, Jeremiah, you're grounded. You're going to get in trouble. You're making some bad choices. And so Jeremiah, and they were consistent father, consistent home. Jeremiah snuck out that night, hooked up with a buddy who wasn't a good guy, went to a convenience store in town, and unknown to Jeremiah, the guy went in, the other kid went in and shot the convenience store owner in the chest and killed him. Jeremiah was made an example, so he was given life with no possibility at 16. He was treated like an adult. So here's Dave, this pastor of this small town, everybody knows him, and his son's going away for life. He ended up getting out, but it was after 20 years. So a 16-year-old's gone away for 20 years. And Dave told me, and he said, Terry, his wife's name is Hope, and she's well-named because she needed hope. But he said, we spent, for 20 years, every Thanksgiving and Christmas, our meals were out of vending machines at the prison. That's where they spent their 20 years of holidays. And so their other kids spent their holidays there as well. So it's a terrifying story when you think about it. I mean, because that kind of stuff can happen. But there was a tremendous... Jeremiah got out. He got out 20 years. And prison did not harden him. It softened him. He lives in the same town as his Dave, my friend. He married a gal who he met as a pen pal, who's a believer. And so it was a good ending. But it's hard to kind of feel like it's a good ending when you think about 20 years. And the perspective that I want you to get from that is not that you need any more fear about this. If you're a parent, you already have ample amount of fear. But you can choose to go a direction that will, your child can choose to go a direction that will make you sad or break your heart. You cannot guarantee outcomes with your best choices. And so my point is to try to diss you of that illusion. Because I think when you're under the illusion that if I can just do everything right, then my child is guaranteed going to have a good life and not make bad choices. With that perspective, which is not real, you're not going to have a sound strategy that's going to stay the course as things around you move. So you can make choices that will make good choices easier and more compelling for your child. That's the appropriate perspective, in my opinion. And in the end, you're responsible to be found faithful with your choices, and so faithfulness needs to be your focus. And I believe that faithfulness as a focus is going to give you a long-term perspective. It's going to help you not get tempted with short-term grabs for relief when things get challenging. It's not going to keep you from moving all around in your parenting. It's going to give you, you're going to move around in your tactics, but it's going to give you a settled direction in terms of your overall vision. It gives you the parameters for your parenting. So I want to give you first, tonight I want to focus on a part of what my and Christy and I are, our philosophy of parenting. You say, well, I didn't come here for a philosophy. I came here for practical help. Philosophy is a word that comes from two words, philos and sophia. Philos is Philadelphia, brotherly love. So philos is love. Sophia is wisdom. Philosophy is a lover of wisdom. And so think of a philosophy like the rules and goals of a sport. When you know what are the rules, what are the objectives? You can understand how to play. You can practice at getting better. You know what's allowable, not allowable. It tells you what things are inbounds and out of bounds. It keeps you on track when you're tired, confused, distracted. So what are the desired outcomes? How are they best achieved? That's why there's coaching philosophies, leadership philosophies, philosophies of science, teaching philosophies, ministry philosophy. Everything humans do there is a philosophy for that when they do it well. And so philosophy determines your goals and roles as a parent. Helps you not be sidetracked by ideas, issues, day-to-day emergencies and challenges. So if you use like World War II as an example, the vision of World War II in Europe was victory in Europe. That was the vision, pretty simple. The strategies were built around that goal. So they formed these large sweeping strategies like land in Normandy on D-Day and then take march into Germany. Those were the larger movements. But then the tactics were all the day-to-day choices designed to accomplish a strategy that was in line with the overall goal. This is parenting. It's not war. But in a sense, you're in a war for the long-term good of your child. And without this long-term perspective, you're going to find yourself living completely tactically. You know, bang, 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 run, 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 boat, 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 you know, fly, fly, fly. And it's disconnected from an overall plan or strategy or vision. So I'm going crazy. This is not working. I need a new book. I need a new plan. I need a new kid. I need a new husband or I need a new wife, whatever. And I'm not saying you're not going to go crazy with if you have a sound philosophy, but I'm saying it's going to help you stay sane. And this is the right, is this the right direction ahead? Is this what faithfulness looks like? Yes, okay, then I may need to change what I'm doing day to day, which you're going to, a lot. But I can't punt on the overall vision. So you can adjust your choices to fit the goal or the vision, but you can't change the goal or the vision to fit new choices. So it's important that you have, I believe, it's important you have a well thought through, rather than just sort of doing what happens, that you've thought through, well thought through, biblically principled. You're not going to be able to go through and find rules 1 to 100 for parenting from the Bible. They're just not in there. There are some specific things for parenting, like don't exasperate your children. But most of what you're going to find in the scripture related to parenting is going to be principle-driven. And in principle, you're going to find every single thing you need to know related to your children, but it's going to be in principle form. So well thought through, biblically principled, coherent, meaning it's not self-contradictory. It can't be confusing. The parts have to work together. And then faithfully applied philosophy of parenting. If that sounds complex, it shouldn't be. Because essentially your philosophy of parenting is, what is my goal as a parent, what is my role as a parent, and then how do I tactically live that out? So what's your goal, what's your purpose as a parent, what's your role as a parent, and then what are the specific choices you make day to day, big and small, to adapt them to that goal and role? So what's your goal as a parent? Your goal as a parent is a subset of your goal as a person. So you have to ask yourself, what is your goal? What's your vision for your life as a person? Why are you here? And parenting is a subset of that. I mean, that's no news value in that. But if you ask, why am I here on earth, parenting is a subset of that. Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created, things in heaven on earth, visible, invisible, thrones, powers, rulers, authorities, all things are created by him and for him. And so your goal as a person, it should be to honor God with your life, to be faithful, to bring him glory. Parenting is a subset of that. Everything is a subset of that. Your role as a parent, 1 Corinthians 4:2, is required those who have been given a trust, your children are a trust, must prove faithful. So your goal is to glorify God with your life, and your role is to be found faithful with what God gives you. So understanding faithfulness as a parenting philosophy is important, I think. And there's a heart level to it and then a practical level. And you may have seen, there's two models that have been enormously helpful for me in parenting and also in talking to people who are parenting. But I want to apply them to parenting today. And the first one is goals and desires. And I got this from a Larry Crabb seminar I went to, gosh, 30 years ago. And I've used it hundreds of times in my own life and other people's lives. And it's a, go ahead, Rodney. And so in this model, which some of you are familiar with, but I'm going to do it again because it's really important. It talks about working on your heart. I'm going to define goal as what you have to have. If I don't get this goal, basically I'm a failure, my life is over. I'm going to define desire as something I really want, maybe desperately want, but I'm not going to be destroyed if I don't get it. So for our illustration, that's the definition of goal and desire. Sound good? So you're heading for a goal, and the goal, let's say the goal for this person, this parent, is my child make it all the way through life, unscathed by rebellion, turn out well, happy family, happy grandkids, not go to jail, just everything's great, perfect. That's the goal. So next slide. So the problem is you don't have complete control over that goal. Who else has some say in that? Your child. They can block your goal. Next slide. When a goal gets blocked, things start happening inside of us. Anger, frustration, there's this cascade. Anger, frustration, denial, kind of like stages of grief almost, and then despair. And I've watched this happen. I've watched this happen in people's lives. I watched a man who lost his whole family by another person's choice. And he could not live, he thought, without his family back. And he, you know, he was sitting in his garage with a gun in his hand because his goal was blocked. There's nothing he could do to obtain his goal. It was outside his choice. His wife had left him and took his kids. Next slide. So when your goal is blocked, you eventually end up in despair. Next slide. So what happens, what needs to happen continually in our hearts, and this is theoretical, but I hope you see how practical it is at the heart level, is you have to, if my goal is anything other than faithfulness to God, it can be blocked. And this doesn't mean that him wanting his, I mean, there's very few things you want more than your children to come out well. By desire, don't hear me saying, it's kind of, I'm okay if I get it, I'm not. No, you can be heartbroken if you don't get a desire. But you're not destroyed. You're not, your life is not over. It doesn't stop you. What happened, what I've seen happen is when people, their goal becomes, I'm going to be found faithful. My desire remains, I want my kids to turn out well, or I want my, Dave, I want my kid to get out of prison, or whatever. When the goal is faithfulness to God, then God can block it and you can block it, and God's not going to block it. It's really important. If anything else is your goal, using our definition, it's blockable by somebody or outside your control. So it's really important. Next slide. This is, you've heard this a lot before, but this is the, that was the heart level. You've got to keep working at the, at have I turned a desire into a goal? And we'll talk about some ways you can sense when that's happening. This is the practical level of that, how you go about kind of living that way as you're looking at your parenting, as you run into difficult times or decisions. You know, you guys know this, you guys know this model, but I would literally do this. And the left column are things that are not completely within your control, but things that are really important to you. And list those. When I've been with people who have been in desperate situations, I'll ask them to list, I'll have them write down, list the things in the left column that are keeping you awake at night, that are making you despair, that you can't control. And they can write that list like quick. I'll say, write the things in the right column that you have complete control over that impact this. And they'll say, there's nothing there sometimes. And so I'll say, nothing there? So we'll start building the right column. And I'll say, okay, now the next step is I want you to pray in the left column, and I want you to go live in the right column. And that's a practical way of kind of switching those, when the goals and desires get switched. I like to say that the left column keeps you awake at night, the right column gets you up in the morning. And you've got to work at that. It's not easy. So faithfulness is a parenting philosophy. Here's a couple of big ticket items. Long-term faithfulness, no surprise to you if you've been a part of this church. Long-term faithfulness requires community. To stay faithful through the years requires living in community. It is one of God's most important resources for your life. Parenting is a subset of your life. It's one of your most important resources for parenting. It is true that your child cannot succeed in life alone, but in the end, you cannot do life for them. And so, you can't parent. Nobody can parent for you, and you can't parent well alone. That's this tension. So no one in the church can do it for you, but you're not going to do well all by yourself. I was had lunch with Robert Garner, who's the assistant superintendent of schools, goes to church here, and maybe it was Greg and I were talking about it, but he had the administrators were together, and they were given this scenario where, and they were trying to build empathy for understanding a lot of the kids in the school system and the parents. And so Robert was given these cards that said, here's who you are. And so they gave him a card. It's okay, you are a single dad with a 20-year-old with a baby, not married, a girl, and then you have a 7-year-old boy. And then, okay, that's the scenario. Then they start slapping cards on him. And each 15 minutes is a 24-hour period of time in this scenario. So you're going through these days. And so Robert said, by 9 o'clock in the morning, I was fired from my job. The scenario overwhelmed him. He's like, okay, this happened, this happened, this happened. And I can't get to work. I'm trying to get my kid to school. And he said, I looked up, and I hadn't seen my son for like 5 days. And he said it was overwhelming. And it built empathy for the people they deal with. These are their real world. And it's not a far-fetched scenario. Robert grew up with in a broken home. He had a half-brother who lived down the street with his buddy. Didn't even know it was his half-brother. Matter of fact, last year, I had his half-brother works in the wing I'm in, and his name was Nick. And so I was in McAllister's. Where else would I be, Brian? And I was in McAllister's with Robert, and Nick walked in. I said, hey, Robert, I want you to meet a friend of mine from the wing. He goes, yeah, that's my half-brother. I had no idea. And so Robert came from this really difficult background, but there were some factors in his life that made a difference. And so at dinner, I said, Robert, let's go back in the scenario. Everything's happened that you described. It's all falling apart. And let me throw down a scenario card. Here's a card. You're that guy, and all that's happening. But you've been in a small group for 5 years, a real small group, and they're plugged into your life. You're plugged into their life, and all of a sudden they're encouraging you. He's not a deadbeat. He just had troubles. They pay your electric bill. They're helping your kids get to school. I said, so if I put that card in a scenario, what changes? He said, everything about it changes. Everything. This is God's design. And Robert's story is different because since I met Robert when he was 18 years old, and now he's, how old is he, Greg? 50 years old? I don't know. Huh? 48? Is he your age? Yeah. Everything changes, and that's what happened to Robert's life. You know, the difference has been community. So God's design life such that your best chance for success personally, parenting, marriage, comes as living in like-minded, like-hearted community. So here's a practical application for that. Julia Grant wrote a book called Raising Baby by the Book, The Education of American Mothers. Thank you. And here's what she says. She said, I don't care whether you let your baby cry out at night or not, but she's interested in why you think an expert's book as opposed to your mother or your church or your own common sense might give you a trustworthy answer. And she outlines the changes in the expert's views over the years. So she outlines the behavioralism of the 30s, the democratic child raising of the 40s, the psychoanalytical 50s, and then the Spock years in the 60s. If you're not familiar with him, I call it the Lord of the Flies parenting. It's just wild child parenting. And each school of thought rose and fell, and the experts were discredited by the next expert. But everybody en masse believed the next one. So this decade, this was the gospel. Then, like, that was nonsense. But this is the gospel. That was nonsense, but this is the gospel. And she's wondering, why is it that when every time these big schools of thought get discredited, people continue to buy into the next one? Reality itself is always self-correcting. It's just ideas are easy to believe, but only truth can be lived long-term. The problem is once reality is self-corrected, you've already raised a generation of messed up kids. So a sure sign of a faulty belief is you can't live consistently with it. However, it sometimes takes years to realize that. So Grant's conclusion was the best thing the church can offer parents is not another list of books by parenting experts, and that's fine to read them, but a network of child-rearing knowledge, community mentoring. I asked Greg and A, why are you guys here? You should be teaching this. And she said, because I want to learn what you're teaching other parents so I can help other parents. Their kids are raised and they've done well. We have this collective expertise. We have people at different levels of parenting. And she helps Christy and I grandparent and parent our kids now. She gives time to helping us. So Grant said, we learn to care for children in the context of the families and the communities in which we live. Without this help, the conflicting advice of the expert just makes us more confused. So I'm not a parenting expert, but my conviction is no one is all by themselves. But I am a part of a community of collective expertise. And so if you're looking for the magic bullet, you're not going to find it, but you are going to find people, like-minded people in community, whether it's River or Orchard, where you're going to be able to do pretty well. But you have to get over the idea that the expert is always from out of town with a briefcase. You know, the prophet's not without honor except in his own town. So somebody, I could send Brian to Atlanta, and they think he's brilliant. And then he came at River, and that's Brian. I see him playing the guitar. Who is he? And that's kind of how we got to get over that. The reality is there's enormous expertise right here. And this is who God has given us. So second big ticket item, faithfulness is direction, not perfection. You've heard that before, but apply that to parenting. Because the failed pursuit of perfection can rob you of emotional and spiritual energy needed for successful direction, long-term direction. And direction, faithfulness, not perfection, flawlessness, is the way we're to think and act in terms of parenting. So here's a question. How do you measure your success as a parent? How do you measure success? Think about that just for a minute. How do you measure success as a parent? If your mind went to all the ways in which I want my kid to turn out, I didn't ask you, how do you measure success for your child? I said, how do you measure success as a parent? That's two different things. So, Corey, my middle daughter, has three kids, Ellis, Nora, and Ollie. Ollie has been a labor-intensive kid since day one. And he hadn't changed. Great kid. Nora has been labor-intensive since day one because she has serious medical problems. Ellis has been the easiest baby. I mean, it's almost like he's not even a real baby. He's just like a wind-up toy. He just, you know, he's easy. And if Corey would have had him first, it would have ruined her because she'd have thought she was a great parent. But Ellis is just a perfect baby. And so I noticed how over and over, I say we, but really the girls, Chris, Ellis is such a good baby. Ellis is such a good baby. Ellis is such a good baby. And so finally I jokingly said, does this mean Ollie and Nora are bad? What does that mean? And so they laughed because I knew what they meant, but we admitted we call Ellis a good baby. Why? Because he's easy for us. He makes life easy for us. He was good because he made our lives easier. So, and we love all three of them. That's not the point. But it shows in a funny way, because we didn't really live out of that, but how we define success. They don't embarrass me. They make my life easier. They don't cause trouble. So how do you measure success as a parent? I think that you have to measure success in terms of direction, not perfection. And direction, what's the vision? To be found faithful. You say, well, what does that even mean? How do I even know how to do that? It's easier to know how to do that when you know that's what you're trying to do, I think. So my friends Dave and Hope, if I said 10 years into Jeremiah's 20 years old and he spent 16 to 20 in prison and now he's 26, and I say, so Dave, are you failures or are you successful as parents? What would he say? I don't know. I mean, I imagine they felt like a failure every day for 20 years. I will say that it broke Hope's health. Her health has been permanently broken by that. So how do you measure success? You got to go back to 1 Corinthians 4:1 and 4:2. 4:2 is required those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I'm going to beat this drum because it's the right direction to go in your heart. And if you keep your heart going that direction, you have a better chance of your actions flowing out of it. God's given you a trust. God requires faithfulness. It doesn't mean you don't care how your kids turn out. Nothing matters more. But if you give your, if you make anything other than faithfulness your main thing, then you're going to live with fear and anxiety related to the future. You're going to live with depression related to the past. I've had people recently tell me, I've screwed my kids up irrevocably and their kids aren't even that old. And then panic, control, anger, or passivity in the present. All those are bad, past, present, future. So our children's best hope for success in terms of our efforts as parents and our best hope for sanity as we raise children is to fix our heart continually on what does it mean to be faithful. I'm going to trust God with the outcomes. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. If you see it, it's not faith. And so are we going to parent with faith or not? So you got to keep struggling to order your goals and desires and then make choices based on that proper ordering. I think parents in America, statistically, research has shown, are extremely anxious, very depressed, and controlling as a whole. I think it's because they are not guarding their heart. They don't have an ordered perspective. So Proverbs says, above all else, guard your heart because out of it flow all the issues of life. The issues of life include parenting. Guard your heart first. Focus on what you can control. So this is enormously difficult to do, enormously important to do. I've spoken with parents over the years. We have some in our church who have adult children, and their adult children have broken their hearts. There's a guy in our church whose adult child he had to get a restraining order against. Had to have him arrested recently. You know, you talk about a heartbreaking scenario. And this person has come to the place to where he's living in the right column, But it's not because of years of choosing to give the left column to God and live in the right column. It's years of failing at controlling the left column. And it's finally out of despair. He had no choice but to live in the right column because he just beat his head against the wall so long, and now he's got a, you know, an older child who's continuing to bring him heartbreak. And so he's resolutely in the right column now, but he got there because life just forced him there. I think it's way better to practice right column living out of a determined choice rather than life forcing you there. And so let me give you a verse that can help shape your thoughts on this. It's a very familiar verse, two verses. Don't be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. The peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. This is an enormously practical verse, but it sounds more bumper stickish or wall hanging ish. God's peace will guard your hearts and minds. Sounds sort of warm and fuzzy. What we hope that means is when I pray, God will make me feel better. That's what we kind of hope. And that's what it sounds like. But there's a lot more going on. Let's look at it. Don't be anxious. That's a command. Don't be anxious. So don't allow worry to take over your mind. This is an ongoing conscious decision. I decide to not let worry take over my mind. Is that possible? It is. Is it difficult? It is. In everything, take the things you worry about and give them to God. This is an ongoing conscious decision. I had something, Christy knows about it, that concerned, the last 3 weeks concerned me. And I'd think about it at night, and in the morning I'd think about it, and it impacted my life, and I was worried about it. And I wasn't asking God to help me feel better. I was telling God, I am not going to be anxious about this. Instead, I'm going to give it to you. And I gave it to him over and over and over, all day long. And then I said, I'm going to make decisions on what I do and don't do based on me not being anxious about this. And then it says God's peace will set a watch. It says the peace of God will guard your hearts and minds. The word there is guard is a sentinel or a watchman who's standing there, you know, halt, who goes there? And what the sentinel is doing is like, here comes a, your hearts and minds are getting out of bounds. They're getting outside the gate, and the sentinel goes, get back in there, out of bounds. Or maybe think of like a referee. You could also, in a modern vernacular, you could say, we'll referee your hearts and minds to Christ Jesus. What that means is you're playing soccer, and you get out of bounds, and the referee blows the whistle. You're out of bounds. Stop. Stop play. Get back in bounds and play again. That's what's going on here. And so the Holy Spirit guarding your hearts and minds is your worry is sounding an alarm. It's throwing a flag. And it's saying, you're out of bounds. You're living outside the boundaries of who you're supposed to be. Get back in bounds. The alarm is going off. No peace, no peace, no peace. That's what guard your hearts and minds. It doesn't mean it'll make you feel better. It means he's going to say, think and choose better. And guess what happens? Over time, you begin to change. So the peace of God is this referee blowing the whistle when your mind and emotions run out of bounds. Whenever we feel a lack of peace about our what's going to happen to our kids and this choice and oh my gosh, look at what he's doing, and is he going to turn into a criminal or whatever, it can send us looking for, to quote a 70s Eagles song, peaceful, easy feelings. That's what we want. Oh God, give me peaceful, easy feelings. That's not what you need. What you need is a referee to tell you, get back in bounds. Your goals and desires have been misordered. So we can you have to train this way. See Philippians 4, 6, and 7 as actionable things you do in cooperation, collaboration with the Holy Spirit to keep you in bounds. Third big item, does faithfulness guarantee results? Yes and no. What results are you referring to? If you're faithful, if Wes is faithful every single day of his life, he doesn't make a mistake, not one. There's a guarantee his children are going to not make any mistakes. No. So if you say, does faithfulness guarantee results, what are you referring to? You're saying, does it guarantee I'm going to have good children? Or is it a guarantee I'm going to hear well done, good and faithful child someday? You know, which one of those does it mean? Does it mean your choice, your child has no choice but to succeed if you're faithful? Or does it mean I give my child the best chance for success if I'm faithful? Very different. So here's what you'll hear. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not turn from it. Isn't that a guarantee? Is it a guarantee? Well, one, it's a misunderstanding of what Proverbs is. Proverbs are general descriptions, general truths about the way life often works. They're principled approach to life. They are not penny in, candy out. For instance, Proverbs 10:27, the fear of the Lord adds length to life, but the years of the wicked are cut short. Has any righteous person ever died young? Has any wicked person ever lived old? But is that verse true? It certainly is. Living in line with the Lord's will and ways maximizes lifespan. There's no question about it. Living otherwise shortens your life. It's a general principle about the way life works. God has different wills for different people in terms of the length of their life, but there's no question that the ones who walk with God, they have a different quality and quantity of life than those who don't. Proverbs 22:6 is not Christian determinism, that my choices determine my child's choices, and they have no choice but to obey God. But it does mean that my choices incredibly impact my child's opportunity to choose. It matters. So faithfulness as a life direction guarantees the pleasure of God, and that you will have done what you can to make a level path for your child to choose to walk with God if they choose to. That's no small thing. Number four, faithfulness. To maintain this perspective, you're going to have to be kind to yourself as a parent. And different parents are different. What I've found is that a lot of parents feel bad a lot of the time. They just sort of perpetually feel guilty. And sometimes one parent does, sometimes one doesn't. Often in my experience, it's the wife who feels bad most of the time, the dad some of the time, or some dads none of the time. So you've got to personally capture two big biblical principles, and these are parenting principles because they impact you as a parent and your ability to continue on well, and not just beating yourself up constantly is taking priceless energy away from what you could be doing for your child. It's sideways energy. You're trying to run a race. If you're beating yourself up, you're running sideways, back and forth across the starting line, and you could be putting that energy into actually doing something productive. So however you do it, you've got to get a handle on what it means to actually be forgiven day to day. 1 John 1:9, if we confess our sins, he's faithful and just, forgive our sins and forgive us of all unrighteousness. Mess up, fess up, move on. Mess up, fess up, move on. You have to get that as a parent. See what I'm saying? There are a lot of principles in the Scripture that you don't think apply to parenting, but do. This one does. Because if you don't, Bill Bright, the Campus Crusade founder, he called it spiritual breathing. 1 John was spiritual breathing. That needs to be, you exhale repentance, you inhale forgiveness. You exhale repentance, you inhale forgiveness. And you move through life that way. It's not like I messed up, and so I'm going to go into despair for an hour or a day. Meanwhile, what's happening? What's happening to your kids? I'm not saying you leave them, but you're not all there like you could be. And this is a promise. If you want a promise from God as a parent, this is one that's set in stone. Exhale, repentance. Inhale, forgiveness. Right now. You blow up at your kids. Do you got to do penance for 3 days now? No, you can. God, forgive me. Child, forgive me, and then move on. Very important. So, number five, faithfulness is learning to live in the now and see the future. Anxiety is future-based. Depression is past-based, generally. Faithfulness is present-based. It doesn't mean that you don't glance at the past and look into the future, but it means you live faithfully in the present. The only place you can be faithful is in the present. So you deal with the past as you have to. You look in the future to make decisions, but you live faithfully in the present. And part of being faithful in the present is seeing the implications of immediate decisions now for the long term. And that's having that big time horizon, seeing the big picture. My experience and research has borne this out. It's not always true. Dads are wired for long-term strategic parenting. Moms tend to be wired for short-term tactical parenting. I've seen it reversed, but statistically, and it doesn't mean, you know, there's anything wrong or bad with you as a mom or dad if it's reversed. It doesn't matter. The good thing is that usually one or the other has a strength in that. Because if in the war for your child's well-being, which is more important, big strategy, big vision, or living tactically day to day? You got to have both. It doesn't matter who focuses on what. It matters that both are in place and both value what the other one brings. And so as parents, that you value the one who sees the long term and the short run, and you value the one who's living right there, right now. Christy and I, there's no question that she was the tactical part and I was the strategic. And my humorous but realistic example would be Crystal scrapes her knee, and I can't wait to ask Crystal what she learned from it while she's still crying. And Christy's down there pushing me away, trying to you know, bandage her knee. When all three of my kids had wrecks, when Crystal had a wreck, her fault, I probably was too soon telling her, what do you learn from this? And Christy was applying comfort. But we need both. Because if you don't have a long-term vision, then your child is just going to go from this to this to this to this to this. You need both. And if you just have a visionary, then your children aren't going to get the nurturing that they need. So you have to have this time horizon where you work together and you value each other. And maybe sometimes one person has a longer perspective and the other person is in the moment. Maybe you switch. Maybe it's always the same. But you learn to live in the moment and keeping your eye on the big picture. So a philosophy of parenting gives you some indications that you're out of bounds. Just like if you know the rules of a basketball game, you know when you go out of bounds. If you go out of bounds, you're not playing anymore. You're not going to score. You're not going to achieve the objective. So a philosophy of parenting can give you some indications you're out of bounds. And so let me give you some indicators that you're losing sight of faithfulness, that you're out of bounds. And these are three big ones that I've seen: performing, passivity, and pushing. Performing is just what it sounds like. It's parenting for the crowds or parenting for someone else. I had someone who was close to our family who, when she was a younger parent, her discipline for her child was on display. And it would embarrass us. It would embarrass the child, because she was performing for us. She was insecure. She was performing for us. It was kind of an overt example of this. But Galatians 1:10 said, "Am I trying to win the approval of men or of God? If I'm trying to please men, I'm not a servant of Christ." So, parenting principle, Galatians 1:10. Parent for the applause of God, nobody else. And so when you lose sight of faithfulness, you can find yourself parenting for the approval of someone else. You say, "Well, I've got parents who are always telling me this and telling me that." There's a whole lot of scenarios where this can get difficult. But if you stick with the principles, you're more likely to come up with applications. So you can ask questions and I can try to give you my thoughts on them from experience. But there's a lot of scenarios where, what about this, what about that? But if you start with principles, you can come up with applications. I'm not saying you're not teachable, that you shouldn't learn from others, but don't try to look like a good parent for the people around you. And I'm gonna be honest, you're never gonna get over that. I was telling Jim, I was starting to say it's embarrassing to admit this, but it's really not, because it's just so silly. But we had our 40th high school reunion last night. 40 years. I mean, if I cared about those people, I would have seen them before now. I haven't seen them in 40 years. And it's not that they don't matter, but I mean, they're just not my friends. I mean, I only knew them 3 years. I haven't seen them for 40. The whole thing was weird to me. And so I got a call: would you come do a memorial service for our dead classmates? I'm like, man, how do you say no to that? But I was going to say no to that. So I told Christy, I'm not going. She goes, "You need to pray about it." So I prayed about it. So I went. And but yesterday, as I was thinking about going to see these people I haven't seen in 40 years, I probably won't see again. And what did I think about all day long? How do I impress these people? All day long. And I was like, stop thinking that. That's so stupid. But then I'm working this, man, am I going to look good? Am I going to say the right thing? This is so stupid. You're 58 years old. And I was trying not to think that all day. And I finally said, why are you trying not to think that? I finally just said, God, I'm 58 and I'm still worried about what people think about me. So would you please help me bless people tonight? Because obviously I'm not going to stop worrying about impressing them. But while I do that, can you help me bless them? And I stopped fighting against, you know, what's going to be true about me till I die. I didn't act on that. I didn't go and, like some of my classmates who were trying to be impressive, you know, I didn't act on it, but it was in my heart. Don't make it your goal to not care what people think about you as a parent. I think that's probably a dumb goal. But I think it's a goal to not act on that and to recognize it and just say, God, I really care about the fact that my mother-in-law or father-in-law or the teacher is judging my parenting. I care a lot about that. It bothers me. It makes me mad. Now help me not act on it. We had teachers. Christy had a teacher that really judged her parenting in a certain situation. And I've only seen Christy mad like once. She was mad, but she didn't act on it. And so don't become stubborn, isolated, insecure about this. Listen to people, but don't play for the crowd. No one is dead to the beast of ego, but just work hard at doing what's right before God for your child. Move away from the pull to look like a certain kind of parent. Die to the desire to live through your children. They're not your avatars. They belong to God. You're a steward. They are not your masterpiece, and they're not your disaster if they turn out bad. They are your child. You know, you love them. So, you know, you could, here's a scenario, you could raise great children who turn out loving God, and you could be a disobedient parent all along the way because your heart was rebellious to God. It's impossible you obey God and your children choose to disobey Him. So the point is you need to make peace with faithfulness. And as you do, you're more likely to live a life of faith before your children rather than looking like a desperate person trying to determine the outcomes. So the second indicator of being out of bounds, when the flag goes up, you're out of bounds. The opposite and equally bad twin of performing is passivity. Ephesians 6:4, fathers, this is addressed to fathers, don't exasperate your children, instead bring them up in training and instruction of the Lord. You can't be a passive parent and pull that verse off. And exasperation can come through over-controlling or through under-directing. But passivity is self-protective. It's either lazy or fearful. Or maybe you've learned it from somebody else, but passivity keeps you from getting up and moving into what needs to happen. You can't do that. Combat research for units that had large numbers of post-traumatic stress disorder, not individuals, but predictors of larger numbers per unit, the number one predictor was not combat exposure, it was the quality of the leadership. So you have this unit that had this many days in combat, this unit had this many days in combat, this one has fewer PTSD, this one has more. What was the difference? The difference was what the followers thought of the leaders. I thought that was one of the most fascinating studies I've ever heard. And when they dug down into it, it was the character and consistency of the leader, including would they acknowledge error, did they have clear rules of engagement, here's what's right, here's what's wrong, here's the mission. And then trust. They thought the leader was going to put them first, not self first. Those units had lower instances of PTSD. And it was the direct impact of leadership on the emotional status of the troops and on the success of the troops. And I think that applies to parenting. So passivity is putting me first. Either I'm fearful or I'm lazy, I'm tired, something's making me passive. I don't know what to do. You don't know what to do, find out what to do. But you don't get to be passive. If you're wired to be more passive, this is no slam on you. You can't be that way as a parent. When I talked to my three son-in-laws when they were going to be interested in my daughters, I said the three big beasts that I've seen ruin marriages are, from the guy's standpoint, moral impurity, anger, and passivity. All guys struggle with moral purity. Not all guys lose the battle. All guys get mad. Not all guys are angry men. All guys struggle with passivity. Not all guys are passive men. So I'm not saying you aren't occasionally passive, but you can't be passive. And do what's right. Do it because it's right. Do it at the right time. Make that your goal. And if you mess up, fess up and move on. Passive parents will often become passive-aggressive parents because they'll be passive because it's hard, tired, inconvenient. They don't know what to do. They'll reach their limit. And then they'll often take inappropriate and inconsistent action. That's how you exasperate your children. Inconsistent, inappropriate action or lack of action. Both of those flow out of passivity. So passivity is the enemy of appropriate and consistent leadership. And then pushing. You can't lead from behind. Parents, you're a leader. You lead from the front by showing, demonstrating, encouraging, calling, or alongside, one step ahead. And eventually the goal is, one of the long-term desires is that the day will come when you walk beside your grown child in friendship. Mutual friendship, mutual impact. And that's a wonderful thing when that happens. It was a dream of ours, and now we get to live it. And I'm telling you, it's just nothing, very few things more satisfying. But before that time, you have to lead. Pushing is this. And it's often driven by selfishness, not always, but it could be a lack of understanding, but wanting to live vicariously through your child, or wanting to behave in certain ways so that they'll make you look good or not make your life so hard or whatever. So whenever you find yourself with performing, pushing, passivity, then that's the red flag's been thrown. You're out of bounds. You've moved from faithfulness as your goal, and you've made something else your goal. So beliefs, values, action. It's a good model of understanding a framework for parenting. Your beliefs, what are your core beliefs? And that's, I gave you a philosophy of parenting. If you don't know what your core beliefs are related to parenting, then you're going to tend to respond randomly or just tactically versus purposely and strategically. You may not know what to do right now, but you know where you want to go. And if you don't know what your core beliefs are, you're not even sure where you're trying to go with all this. Your values are from what you believe, now you know what's most valuable. And you can now value what's valuable. And so you want to see, and my values show up in what I do, what I give my time and effort and money and so forth to. My actions flow out of my values, and my values should be tied to my beliefs. So what do you value, and then what are you going to do? So let me give you some examples of some things that Christy and I valued. We did not do this perfectly at all, but these are some things we valued. We valued for our kids that all this stuff looked real to them. I call it a single story life. You can call it whatever you want. But it was a high value for us that this looked real. And one of the examples I've used was, you know, my dad and my mom really wanted us, they wanted spirituality to be real for us, and they didn't know what to do. So I remember my dad decided one time we were going to have family devotions. Don't hear me saying family devotions are wrong. If they work and you like them, do them. But he decided that's what we needed to do to make this real. And so he would bring us in when we were ready to go play. He'd set us down in the living room, and he would start reading a verse to us, give a Bible study. And I mean, I was an ADHD or ADD boy, and it was miserable. And we made it so miserable for my dad, he finally said, after, we're not doing this again. So that was the end of our family devotion, because we drove him crazy. And then I read a book before we had kids, and it was about theology, but it had a story in there where the guy said, the way they did family devotions, this is long before Crystal was born, he said, well, for instance, they'd be out playing on the playground. Some of you heard this before. They'd be on a playground, and he'd go, hey, you guys having a good time? And they go, yeah, it's just fun. So his little kids, he'd go, let's tell God we're glad. They go, God, we're glad. Family devotion. I said, I like that. That makes good sense. And so we did that. So I would think about it, but we'd go to the park. We'd go for walks. We'd go to Sonic, and I would slip in Bible study and truth. And I said, you guys having fun? Yeah, well, just tell God we're having fun. They go, God, this is fun. Or maybe we'd pray along the way. And I wanted it to look real. This is real life. It's not like we're going to have our devotionals, sit there, be quiet, and then now go back to being little kids. I wanted it to be a single story, seamless life. Because it is. I believe it is. Which brings me to number two, fun. We valued fun. And you have to work at making life fun. My on the flag page, and anybody taking the flag page here, some of you have, it shows you kind of what you love. And there's different countries. So I'm strongly from control country. And fun country wasn't... Chrissy thought fun was going to be on there, but fun, so it was controlled and peace, and they were surprised that fun was very low. How can that be? Because whenever fun was happening in our family, still, a lot of times, I'm the one kind of at the center of it, and I said, that's because I'm control country, and I want to make fun, make sure fun gets done. I want to get fun done. We got to get some fun done here. Okay, fun's done, we're going home. And so we have fun, but it's like, it's still control country. But I wanted to, you got to, if you're naturally fun, that's great. But you want to work at making life fun. Units that were resilient, combat, disaster scenarios, humor was a key part. One of the key resources for resiliency was humor. And we think, you know, when in combat or in disaster scenarios, there's no humor. Those people don't tend to survive. Kids learn, they're designed to learn in the context of fun. It doesn't mean life is always fun. But if life is never fun, they're probably not going to learn. Another thing we valued, obviously, was safety. but we worked together on this. Christy's more of a risk adverse. I'm more of a risk management guy. So it's like, you know, Christy's like, Crystal, that's high enough. And I'm going, that's just arm break. That's not neck break. Go a little bit higher. So we worked together on that. And you want a safe, you want them to feel safe and be safe, but you can't be risk adverse. So this is all part of our overall philosophy. I learned after Christy, these are different people, but the same principles. And that was difficult. Corey, my middle one, was the hardest one for me to figure out. She was a baffling mystery to me. I couldn't figure out. And I had friends tell me, you're not doing very well with Corey. I mean, this was when she was like four. And I got defensive, but in my mind I'm going, I don't understand this kid. This kid makes no sense to me. And so I decided I need to be proactive and go after Corey, figuring this kid out. So one of the things we did when we took that trip together, she was four. So I had to drive to a funeral, my grandma or grandpa's funeral, and it was a 9-hour drive. So the other kids, Christy and the other kids flew, I had to drive, so I took Corey with me. I said, I'm going to try to at least spend 9 hours figuring this kid out. And so one of the things that helped me figure her out, we were driving, and she fell asleep because we were driving into the night. And she sound asleep. We talked for a while, and her mind was all over the place. And I'm like, I don't understand this kid. And then... she finally fell asleep, and I was praying and thinking. And she, about 3 in the morning, she woke up. And she's 4, and she's looking at me. And I looked over, and she was wide awake. And I said, you want ice cream? She goes, yep. And so that's when I started. If Corey is like a party ready to happen any minute. You know, wake her up in the middle of the night, and she's still like that. And so that was one part of who she is. But there were other parts that were really wonderful that I had to work way harder at understanding Crystal than I did Corey or Casey. Same principles, different people. And so the idea I've heard parents say, I don't understand what happened. I treated them all the same. I thought, oh, that's your problem. The principle's all the same, but you can't apply the principles all the same. So this, you got to figure out this kid. Secure. We valued security. We wanted him to be able to look back and say it was secure. I knew I was loved. I knew I was protected. And it was fun. Best learning environments are. And it was real. My parents weren't faking it. God is alive in their lives. And so it was secure. One of the ways that security was important, shown to be important, was I know for a kid, for a kid, what do you think is the number one thing that makes him feel secure for a kid? Any ideas? Most likely, most kids. I mean, if there's no boogeyman under the bed, of course. But how watching mom and dad interact. And so Christy and I, when it was difficult, but when I would sin against Christy in front of the kids, you know, snap, or, and then they would disperse and the Holy Spirit would beat me up, I would make sure that I would confess to Christy in front of the kids. And then we'd make sure that we hugged, you know, didn't just hug and kiss when the kids weren't watching, hug and kiss when the kids are watching. And just doing these things, trying to create security that mom and dad are on the same team in this. So we want them to be and feel secure. Another thing we valued was self-control in them. The first step in leadership is to lead yourself, otherwise known as self-control. And so we wanted to, at appropriate ages, we figured this out, I don't know when, but we figured out we need to help them learn delayed gratification because it's important to self-control. So they need to learn delayed gratification as a personal experiential value, that the best things in life are worth waiting and working for. So we would do things like we'd go on a walk, a DG walk. We call it DG, delayed gratification. So the kids, if you say DG, they know what it means. And so we'd go on a walk, and a walk that was just maybe stretch them based on where they were or something like that. And then at the end, we'd stop and get a Pepsi. And some of you heard this story before, but we walked around Sedgwick County Park one time, and it was kind of about 3 miles, kind of on the limits. So there was some griping towards the end. So our job is, you know, when griping happens, your job as a leader is cast vision, not to flog them, but to cast vision. And so when they were kids, if we'd go to dinner, they'd all share, if we got a pop, they'd share a pop. And I said, you're going to get your own pop. You know, wow. But they were little, so we walked, and they made it. And so they all had their own. We were sitting at Taco Bell, and they all had their own pop. And they said, this is the best pop I've ever tasted in my life. And they went on, and I said, that's called DG. That's DG right there. That's delayed gratification. That's what DG tastes like. And so the implications for that spill over into marriage and work and walk with God. And so if you can, we value that. We saw it was going to be valuable for them. So if you can think of creative ways to do that, and again, blend these together. Delayed gratification by flogging them is not going to teach them anything. So make sure you combine fun with delayed gratification if you can. You know, try to. It's gonna be some griping. If delayed gratification is going on, there's most likely going to be some griping. But your job is to cast vision, and then after a while, you know, you don't know if it's going to happen. You hope it's going to happen that they start learning to do this themselves. And I've watched, you know, Casey didn't like to push herself. And now she's arguably, you know, the toughest one of the three in terms of pushing herself. And she's learned that this is really enjoyable, you know, that it's worth waiting for. And so that has implications for morality and character and all these things. So we value those. And so these are examples of values that flowed out of what we believed, and they're not separate things, you know, real, fun, safe, same people, different, same principle, different people, secure, self-control. They all fit together. They all are part of a seamless whole. So some things that we did, I already told you some things we did, but you can do a lot of things, but hopefully the things you do will flow out of the things you value, flow out of things you believe. We did family nights, and family nights were easy when they were little, because they were, you know, it's like the twins now. They're five, and Crystal and Neil can just, we're having family night, and you know, because they're when their kids are early, their eyes are turned to home, and then at a certain point they start going like that. It's not bad; it's just normal, and so family night becomes more work. But what we wanted was family nights to be fun, not miserable. And so we would, and they weren't expensive. We didn't spend money. We just, I mean, we may went got pizza or something, but we made them fun, age graded fun. And then when they got older, it was hard. It could be because they're going and they're doing plays or musical or sports. But we would, instead of going, we're having family nights, you know, over your dead body, we would say, you know, when you guys want to get together this, when are we going to get together this week? What are we going to do? And so we found ways of doing that in ways that look fun to them. We invested a lot in the lead child, which was Crystal. We had more time with her, but I also saw very often, not always, but very often the lead child is going to lead. And so we tried to invest a lot in her. Doesn't mean we care for her more, but I would try to leverage her to lead the other ones. Church was a priority, but we wanted church to be fun. When I grew up, I didn't see church as fun. Sundays were my least favorite day of the week. My dad, you've heard this before, maybe my dad was tired. He worked all week. He was tired. Sundays was day of rest for him. And day of rest, my dad, meant miserable for, you know, a 10-year-old boy. And so we'd go to church, which was boring, and we'd go home, and my mom would, you know, we'd eat pot roast, and then my dad would go nap and rest. Do what you're supposed to do when you're a tired man on Sunday. And we're like, it's so boring. And when it was nice, we'd go outside, but in the wintertime, it was just boring. So we thought, how do we make Sundays fun? And it was a small thing, but we started when they were little, and we'd go to lunch with friends after church, you know, maybe Taco Bell, something cheap, but we would, instead of going home, and I'm not saying this is some rule, just hear this as an application. We would we'd go to church and we'd go to lunch with parents who had kids their age, and if you ask them now what was their favorite day of the week, it would be Sunday. And it wasn't because we, you know, took them horseback riding every Sunday afternoon. It was just we thought about how do we make this day more fun? And it's one of the reasons why, you know, if you haven't already, you know, your little kids get suckers from your gym on Sunday morning. It's a subtle way. And if your kids want suckers Sunday morning, then send them my way. If you don't want them, then keep them away from me. Because I've found out from several parents, my kid never had candy till today. And so I found, well. But part of that is it may sound like a small thing, you know, but when Wes and Catherine's kids, you think they're gonna remember, you know, getting suckers from who is he? Papa? What is he? Huh? Pop. Yeah. You think they're gonna remember that? You think that's gonna be a part of what Sunday feels like in their psyche? I'm pretty sure it is. And so if you think about how do you make good things feel and look good in age appropriate ways? Church was a priority. If you haven't read the article and you want it, you can, Jim, maybe you can send it. Have you sent that thing out yet about parenting and sports and church and all that kind of stuff? Have you sent that out? I can't remember. You know the... Okay, well, if you want it, you can ask Jim. Tremendous article about making church a priority in your kid's life. It doesn't mean sports aren't important, school's not important. But what's amazed me over the years are parents who they'll punish their kids for not doing homework by saying you can't go to youth group. Now, you can go to football games, you can't go to youth group, or you can go, and do what you want, but don't punish them by keeping them home from what I think is unbelievably valuable for them. Church was a priority for us, and we tried to make it fun. We wanted to make it feel fun. Involve other people. Research has shown that kids who have seven non-family members, that's not the magic number, but around seven non-family members who their kids know, adults who their kids know and who know their kids, there's chances of success go way up. So it's kids who grow up knowing other people than my family. My family have to love me. These people don't have to love me. Who are in my life and they know me, their chances of success go way up. And I do love your kids. It's one of the reasons I try to pay attention to your kids, you know, is I don't mind being one of those people. And so have people over. I mean, the Greers are here, like I said, because They're a resource, and Jim and Patty too. Their kids are raised, but there's resources in this room to be, and in our church to be one of those seven. And then look for ways to celebrate, to look for chances to laugh and dance and play. What I learned from my dad, this is how he's wired, is he's never missed a chance to make a memory. And memories come from two places, really bad times and really good places. And the things you remember the most. So I had a girl at my reunion who was remembering a time when we were at pizza, and she laughed and spewed pop all over me. And Chris said, "You remember that?" I said, "No, I remember that." But she remembered it really well. Why? Because she was embarrassed. I wasn't embarrassed. I don't remember it. So it stood out in her memory from 40 years later because she was so embarrassed by it. So good times and bad times are seared in your memory. So go out of your way. I mean, bad times are going to make themselves, but go out of your way to make good times. Go out of your way to have reasons, to have a party. You have to combine this with delayed gratification. If all of life turns into party, then parties don't mean anything. Look for teachable moments because these are priceless. You don't want to miss them, and they come at inconvenient times. They're going to come maybe at bedtime. They're going to come when you're hurried or rushed. And you can teach and teach and teach, but teachable moments you can't always just make. You can put yourself in situations where they might happen, but when they happen, you got to figure out a way to grab them. And so you got to watch. You got to be alert. One of the most teachable moments in Corey's life was I was dropping her off at school. I was going to drop her off and leave. She was in middle school. And I just asked her some question. I don't even know what it was. And she started crying. So I parked. And we talked for an hour. And it was a turning point for Corey. And it was just I wasn't even being that intentional. But what I was intentional was I can be late. It's not going to be a disaster to be an hour late for what I had to do. And it ended up being, now in retrospect, 20-some years later, it was this profound moment that turned into a movement. And so all I'm saying is don't beat yourself up. You're thinking, "Oh, I've missed all of them." Don't, if that's how you're wired. That's not my point. My point is look for them because they're going to be there. And you're probably going to recognize them. But when they are, and they're not going to, I mean, it didn't feel like a movement at all. It felt like Corey's sad, I need to talk to her. And when I drove away, I thought Corey was sad, and I talked to her. But a year later, I thought, okay, that was big. 10 years later, I thought that was really big. So I'm not saying that there's light shining and, this is the moment. It's just, but the moments are going to be there, and buy them up when they are. I failed a lot, and so I confessed my failure. I've talked to many adults who said their dad never once said they were sorry or I sinned, and that can't be true for you. If you sin against your kids, you have to ask them to forgive you. It doesn't mean you're admitting that you were wrong. If I get on my kids for something they did that was wrong, and Muhammad was telling me in the Iranian culture, if you say you're sorry for being wrong for any part of it, you're admitting that none of it was true. Well, we're not in Iran. And so if you're wrong, you say, "I was wrong for this. I was angry." Because I did a lot of right things in wrong ways as a parent, a lot of them. And so confess your failure. Every time you fail, confess it. And then catch them doing right things. Don't just catch them doing wrong things. The wrong things are obvious. The right things you look for. So 5 minutes left. I'd like you to write down a question or point of further clarification. If you have one on your card with your email, and I'll be quiet for a couple of minutes, question or questions. It can be about something I've said. It can be about something you wish I'd said. It can be very specific. We had very specific things we did related to dating. And it was our conviction, but this is how we did it, and it worked out well for us. People do it differently. So anything you want to ask it, and I'll try to address it in a video.